Hello, I'm Luis Hernandez, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Well, tens of thousands of Haitians right now are living in the U.S. under temporary protected status. That was status provided to Haitians after the 2010 earthquake that killed more than 300,000 people. Now, that protection is going to run out for many of them in January. It means thousands could be deported. Now, some of them have decided to try their luck further north, as in Canada. Ronnie is from Port St. Lucie. He's lived in the U.S. for more than 27 years, and he drove for 3 days to the border where he said goodbye to eight people who crossed into Canada.
As human, we shouldn't be going through all this. And when you send these people back, some of them don't have anywhere to go because some of them, they lost everything during the earthquake. And they come reside here, and there's nothing they can do.
More than 3,800 Haitian migrants crossed into Quebec in the first half of this month alone. But is Canada accepting them with open arms? The Canadian government sent Emmanuel Dubourg, a Haitian-born member of parliament, to Miami's Little Haiti yesterday, and he's urging Haitians, don't make the trip.
The risk is we're going to deport them. And if we deport them, the door is completely closed for them or for the family for next time. So they have to be aware of our system, and there is ways that they can come regularly.
If you or people in your family are here under TPS, what are your options? Is Canada attractive? Where else are you going to go? Give us a call. We'd like to hear your story, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN or find us on Facebook, The Florida Roundup. Joining me now in studio, Jacqueline Charles, Caribbean correspondent for the Miami Herald. Great to have you back, Jacqueline.
Thanks for having me.
Ronnie, this was a gentleman you interviewed.
Yes, I did.
And I mean, I only have his first name.
Because he only wanted to give me his first name. He
okay.
was afraid that he would be accused of human trafficking because he was taking so many people to Plattsburgh. And I actually ran into him in the parking lot of a McDonald's about 5 minutes from the border crossing.
You were up there.
I was up there.
All right. Kind of paint the picture for me of what this place looks like. I mean, is it a border crossing or is it just...
It's a ditch.
It's a ditch.
It's a ditch. It is at the end of a country road called Roxham Road. On your way to Roxham Road, which is basically a half mile stretch, there are a lot of large pastures, horses that are grazing. It's surprising to see that it is New York. It's upstate New York, but it looks like middle America.
No fence.
No security. No security. And when you're there, the houses are very scattered. So these are very, you know, they're farmhouses. But the people who've lived there, they've lived there for years. Who knows, maybe even centuries. It's very close to the Canadian border. At the end of this road, there is an asphalt that ends. And then the dirt begins. And within 10 feet, you're in Canada. So as the migrants or would-be migrants, would-be refugees, whatever you would like to call them, as they show up, and they're showing up in taxis often, and sometimes even the taxis, they don't even come all the way to the border. They stop in the middle of the road.
They take a taxi to the border.
They take a taxi.
Stop right there.
They stop right there. And most of them get to Plattsburgh on a Greyhound bus. So if we back up a little bit, they either fly into New York, into JFK, or a nearby airport. They take a Greyhound to Plattsburgh, and this Greyhound, they arrive at, it's a filling station, a gas station. You don't even know that it's a Greyhound bus station unless you look carefully and you see a sign that says, we sell bus tickets here. And there, from the minute the Greyhound arrives, there are already taxis lined up to take these people. This has now become a business in this little town.
Well, how many people daily are making this trek?
One day, there were 500 people who crossed the border, that very same point in one day. On this particular day when I met Ronnie, I was there early that morning. The bus was supposed to arrive at 6:15. It was an hour late. There were 24 people on that bus. The majority of them were headed to Canada. Many of them had children. Some were pregnant women. They were from all over. They were from Fort Lauderdale. They were from Naples. There were people from California. I mean, they're coming from all over to make this journey. And it's not just Haitians, but the majority of the people who've crossed are Haitians.
Why that particular spot considering how big the border is with Canada. Why there?
Yes, it's interesting. It's a 5,000-mile border. And you have, for instance, the Syrians, they cross through Minnesota. So the Haitians have chosen this particular spot. And I believe probably because, one, it's upstate New York, and it's very easy to cross. When you actually get to the border, the road ends, the asphalt ends. There's a sign that says road closed. And then when you look, you see Canadian police officers. But it literally is like 10 feet from where the asphalt ends to where the Canadian police officers are standing. And it's a ditch that that's basically bridged by a dirt mound.
But so you said that there are Canadian police on the other side.
Yes.
So when they cross that ditch, and then the police are there.
Before you even cross the ditch. As you're walking toward the ditch, the police officers...
Oh, they're there beforehand.
Yes,
okay.
They stand on the Canadian side, and they say, stop. What you're about to do is illegal. If you want to come to Canada, there is an official border crossing at La Colle, which is just a few miles away, and you can go there. But if you decide to cross here, you will be arrested. And all of these individuals, it's as if they've been coached. They don't care. They just bombard their way across. They take 2-3 steps, boom, they're in Canada.
And do they get arrested?
They get arrested, and they are read their Miranda rights. And they are read their Miranda rights either in English or in French, depending on which language they are comfortable with. And the Canadian officers do ask them, do you speak French? Do you speak English? And they are read their rights.
Because I was going to ask, where do they go once they're in Canada? Is there a particular community or a little area where they go?
So where they're crossing is actually Quebec, which is French-speaking part of Canada, Quebec province. So when they cross, they're arrested. There are no handcuffs that are put on them. There's a tent that's been set up. It's a makeshift reception center. There, Canadian officers start to run criminal background checks. We've been told that less than 1% of the people who've crossed have actually been detained, jailed, because they have a criminal history or they came into Canada with pornography. While they're there in this tent, they stay there maybe a couple of hours while they're being processed. Their bags are taken from them. Their cell phones are taken from them. And then they are shuttled to a tent city that the Canadian Army just recently built, because there's so many migrants that are now crossing that the processing is taking days. So you can be in this tent city for 3 to 4 days. And after you're completely processed by immigration, and this is where they were asked for asylum, then they are then transferred to one of 10 shelters, including the Olympic Stadium in Montreal. They had to open the stadium up in order to house these refugees.
So we heard just a moment ago in the introduction, we heard from a Canadian member of parliament who came down to Miami, basically almost telling people, look, there's a process. Don't expect to just come up and you can stay. So, I mean, it sounds though like what you said, they're just going. They're going to go, right?
They are just going without any idea what's awaiting for them on the other side. They have no idea that the immigration laws in Canada are very similar to the United States, that you have to be able to prove asylum, that there is no free ticket, no free residency in Canada, despite what they've seen in these viral messages that have been going on WhatsApp or Facebook.
How much of it has to do with the fact, though, that we've heard from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau? He announced on Twitter some time ago that Canada would take refugees banned by Trump. And of course, critics have argued that, well, you're just saying we're going to accept anybody. And that could be people from Colombia, Mexico, Africa, Middle East, anywhere. But I mean, how much did that play into it?
I think a lot of that's playing into it, because Canada wants to present itself as the antithesis of Trump, the antithesis of the United States in this moment in history. And it is warm and it is welcoming and it has an open immigration policy. But Trudeau does not say, just because you come, we're going to let you stay.
So when they're there, they're detained. They may have to spend a few days in this tent, and some of them are sent back?
Not immediately.
No.
They're put in a shelter, and then they get to file their claims. They're given checks so that they can find an apartment. They get a work permit.
See, that sounds a whole lot more attractive than staying here being afraid.
Exactly, or being put in a detention center in the U.S. So that's also adding to this, because these migrants are comparing the treatment, the warm, open treatment that they receive in Canada, to what they've received in the United States.
But do you think they'll be able to stay, though, or that at some point Canada is going to say, you can't?
This Canadian member of parliament made it very clear that the majority of them will be sent back. That last year, the rate for Haitian refugees in Canada, 50% of them were returned to Canada. Were returned back to Haiti.
And does that mean, return to Haiti? They can't come back here, can they?
No. And that's the other interesting thing with this border. So the people who are crossing, if they leave a suitcase, they left something in the streets, literally 5 feet away, you can't go back and get it. Once you're across, you're in Canada, that's it. Now you're in the Canadian system, now you're subjected to that, and you risk deportation to Haiti.
Some people will say, look, you know what? Every country has its system. You have to follow its rules. But help us paint a picture of why it seems like Haitians here in the United States now trying to get into Canada, why any option is better than going back to Haiti.
For these individuals, when I spoke to them, and I was on both sides of the border, I was on the U.S. side, I was on the Canadian side, and I talked to people who were about to cross and people who had already crossed. And their interpretation of this TPS issue is that Trump has already made up his mind that there's no more TPS for Haitians. They're desperate. They don't want to be deported. They don't want to go back to Haiti. They see no options in Haiti. Despite the fact that temporary protective status was given in 2010, you have people who've been living in the United States much longer than that. They've been here 20 years, 15 years. They had established lives. They have U.S.-born children. For them, the idea of not being able to drive, not being able to work, not being able to take care of themselves, it is just unfathomable. So they have decided, you know what, I'm going to go to Canada. I hear that it's better in Canada. But a lot of them are also making these rash decisions based on misinformation, based on rumors that Canada is offering free residency to Haitians. And that's what the member of parliament was here, you know, trying to inform Haitian leaders and immigration advocates that there is no free residency for Haitian refugees in Canada, that they're going to have to fight and prove that they have an asylum claim. And if they can't prove that, they will be deported back to Haiti.
Again, I'm talking with Jacqueline Charles. She is with the Miami Herald and talking about not just Haitian TPS for Haitians, I should say, but the story that many Haitians are going to Canada, hoping that perhaps they'll be welcomed with open arms, at least, or at least treated differently, better than they are here in the United States. As we've been hearing, thousands going up there, they're arrested the moment they walk in, but their treatment does seem a bit different than maybe what they expect here in the United States. Jacqueline, U.S. Senator Bill Nelson here in Miami earlier this morning, we don't have any sound of this, but he was talking in Little Haiti about the issue of TPS. It ends in January.
It is in January for Haitians, but we also have to note that there are 300,000 Central Americans who are also enrolled in TPS, and they're looking to see what happens with the Haitian situation. And Canadians are bracing themselves for the possibility that now Central Americans will be joining Haitians at this border crossing because people are desperate. Senator Bill Nelson, again, made a plea for them to renew temporary protected status beyond January and not just for 6 months. I mean, he and others have been asking for 18 months. Their argument is that Haiti's just not ready to absorb all of these people.
And the U.S. government says it is.
The U.S. government says that it is. But they have not yet made a final decision about TPS. We expect to know something maybe in November. That will be 60 days before the January deadline.
So what's going on in the Haitian community then here in South Florida as that deadline is, we're getting closer and closer to it. I mean, are people preparing to make the trek to Canada, maybe possibly ended up having to go back to Haiti? And then realistically, you know, how long would it take to deport thousands and thousands of people?
Well, exactly. I mean, people are afraid. You know, they're very fearful. They're very desperate. They don't know what to do. And what adds to that fear is that after a number of Haitians actually renewed their TPS status, they received a letter from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And that letter basically said, we just want to remind you that TPS is only for 6 months. It expires in January. And in the event that it is not renewed, you should start preparing yourself to return to Haiti. Haitians read that as there's no more TPS, it's over, I have to do something. So that's why you've seen that between June and today, nearly 8,000 migrants, asylum seekers, have crossed illegally into Canada. The majority of them, 80 to 85%, are Haitian.
Have you heard from any of the Haitians who are still in Canada? They've been there at least a month or a couple of months, as to what their conditions are like or what life is like for them now?
Much better than Miami, they tell me.
When I
was there and I'm talking to people, and again, we have to remember, though, this is still very fresh and very new for them. The asylum process, the court process hasn't really started because there's so many, so there's going to be a backlog. Under Canadian law, they were supposed to go before a judge within 60 days, but I spoke to a lawyer who says that that's probably won't happen until next year. So in the meantime, they're getting adjusted. You know, they are in the shelters. They're moving from shelters to apartments. There was a story yesterday in the Canadian press that in Montreal, they're going to start receiving welfare checks to help them adjust to this new life. But the interesting thing, too, with a lot of these Haitians is they now have sort of a bad taste in their mouth when it comes to the U.S. They don't want to talk about their lives in the U.S. They don't want to talk about the U.S. They said the U.S. didn't want us. They put us out. And so the only thing I'm concerned about is how do I get to stay right here in Canada? But now that reality of being in Canada, having crossed the border, and that there is no free ticket in Canada, that is starting to sink in. And I think there's where you're going to start to see the panic and things are going to start to change.
And as you said, it seems almost it's become a business, and that, you know, Haitians come up to this one particular place on the border of New York State and Quebec, and you've got buses and cabs taking them right up to the border. They're being arrested as they walk in, but we, as you've told us, their treatment seems to be quite different than what they're getting here in the United States. Jacqueline Charles, again with the Miami Herald, thank you again so much. I really appreciate it. Story that we're going to keep up with.
Thank you for having me.
And again, if you have a story to share on this issue on TPS, maybe you, someone in your family, maybe you're considering going to Canada, share it with us. Find us on Facebook, the Florida Roundup, and please tell us a little bit about your decision, how you're coming to that decision. Coming up next, it was 25 years ago today. We all were walking around outside of our homes. Hurricane Andrew just passed, and we're trying to make sense of what happened. Is Florida ready for another one of those, though, if it came through? That's coming up next on WLRN's The Florida Roundup. Welcome back to The Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So where were you 25 years ago when Hurricane Andrew hit? What was the most powerful memory for you? Now, look, I was living with my family in Doral, and I remember being huddled up in the first floor bathroom as the storm passed through. And I think the memory that sticks with me the most is that, you know what, the wind. It was that howling, roaring wind outside. I'd never heard anything like it. I think the scariest thing actually was all the projectiles that wind was carrying, smacking up against the house. It sounded like cannon. Isaias Torres was 13 when Hurricane Andrew hit, and here's some of his Andrew memory.
The worst part of it, I remember it sounded like a train was passing right out on the other side of the wall, and there was like this howling. It became very eerie after a while. My sister was 10, and she was freaking out. She was crying hysterical from the sound and that rattling of the windows.
It was intense. By the way, I do want to mention that, our best wishes go out to the people in Texas right now as they are bracing for Hurricane Harvey. That probably the first major storm to hit the U.S. in more than a decade. The aftermath was pretty intense as well. Within days, the National Guard, if you remember, came in. So many communities without power for weeks or more, getting basic supplies, making phone calls was so difficult. It's been a quarter of a century. And, you know, we haven't been through anything like that. And you have to ask the question, are we ready if another big storm came through? Think about everything that's changed. Now, supposedly the systems are in place to get power back up, to get supply lines open, to make sure that people can make phone calls in and out. Evacuations, would it be easier today than it was back then? How about all the fact that all these high rises have popped up? What if we had to evacuate those areas? And would you want to stay in a high rise if a Hurricane 5, Category 5, was coming through? We'd like to hear your thoughts on this. If you were here for Hurricane Andrew, tell us about the things that have changed, things you've seen, and what would be your plan today? And if you haven't been through a storm like that, hope that you don't. But just in case, this may be the time to listen. Give us a call, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can tweet us at WLRN. Joining me in studio is John Morales, NBC6 meteorologist. Great to have you back, John.
Thank you. Great to be here.
All right. Also joining me is Palm Beach Post reporter Elliot Kleinberg. Elliot, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And from the Miami Herald, joining us from Doral is Renee Rodriguez.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, great to have you all. Real quickly, what's your biggest memory of any hurricane, but, you know, especially Hurricane Andrew? Let me start with you, John.
Sure. Well, I mean, for Andrew, of course, I was on the air. Those were my Univision days. As many of you know, I started in this market on TV in 1991, and the next year we had Andrew come through. And so, you know, I spent many an hour, probably 24 straight hours on the air there at the station. Meanwhile, my fiance was down in the hammocks area, and she thought she'd move to what was supposed to be a safer area down in Kendall, but it turns out that house was torn apart. So they had a very, very harrowing night. And what you describe regarding the sound, the roar of the wind, that's certainly something that those that live through it will never forget. In our case, you know, speaking of Doral, that's where the station was. Now, Doral saw some wind and saw some damage, but certainly nothing like what was seen from Kendall Drive, so that's Southwest 88th Street, all the way down to Florida City. And those were really the spots where that eye wall of this very, very small but powerful buzzsaw of a hurricane, that's where the major damage was observed. And as you've heard many times, it looked like a bomb had gone off. It was just absolutely hideous.
And I do remember going down to Homestead at one point to volunteer and helping out, and I'd never seen anything like that in my life. And I've been through, I think, every category storm, having spent almost all of my life in Florida. Elliot, what about you?
Well, my dad, who was the longtime editor of the Miami News, Howard Kleinberg, in his memoir commented that of his four children, I went through a different kind of terror because while everybody else was in the middle of the storm in the Falls area, I was 80 miles away in Boca Raton wondering if my family was dead or alive. And then, of course, for being a reporter in Palm Beach County, even though I'd grown up in Miami, it was a local story even in Palm Beach County and the Treasure Coast because the distribution centers were up there. A lot of people came up there for help. A lot of people ended up moving up there. And of course, the evacuation before Andrew went right up through Palm Beach County, and that still scares the heck out of state officials is what's going to happen if everybody leaves again.
Yeah. And Renee, what about you?
I was living in Kendall, and I remember distinctly that the forecast of Hurricane Andrew was that it was going to go, it was going to hit somewhere around North Miami. I was very young. I had never lived through a hurricane. I was very naive. And so I made no preparation whatsoever. And like everybody else, I woke up in the middle of the night. It sounded like there were wolves howling outside my window. And it was such a frightening experience that I had a nervous tic in my right eye for the next week.
And I wonder, you know, 25 years later, Renee, you know, when this anniversary comes up, does it do anything to you?
Well, it makes me hope that we never get anything like that again, because it's such a terrifying experience. You know, I remember I was much younger at the time, but I remember thinking, oh, yeah, this is going to be cool, because there had been so many near misses when I was growing up in Miami, that part of me almost was looking forward to experiencing a hurricane. But after you've been through something like Andrew, you never want to go through anything like that again.
You know what? I hear that. And again, since I've been through enough of them, John, I hear that people have hurricane parties. Yeah. And I'm sure there were people who were doing that during Andrew. But, you know, I don't know. Can you ever deter people from anything like that? I'm sure you say it plenty. I've always heard all of you guys say that plenty of times. Take it seriously.
Well, right. And that's going on right now in the Texas coast, right? So, for example, there are places where the evacuations are not mandatory, but they're strongly encouraged. And, you know, it's funny because there are some countries where they have great success in evacuation and saving lives during hurricanes. But that's because if you don't evacuate, you're going to go to jail, or you know, or you're going to be taken out of your house with an armed guard and rifle. You know, so you know, we don't do that here in the U.S. And sometimes people do stay behind, but then they have to realize that they're definitely putting their lives at risk. For folks in southern Miami-Dade County, Andrew is something that not only is never forgotten, as you were just discussing now, but it's something that has changed their perspective of hurricane seasons forevermore. So, for example, you talk to folks in Southern Dade, folks in Homestead, or maybe deep south in Kendall or Florida City, and hurricane season's around, and they're telling me, no, we're glued to what you say, John, because, you know, we've never forgotten Andrew. We never want to live through something like that again. Andrew was, at the time, the third strongest hurricane ever to strike the United States. Sustained winds were eventually determined to be 165 miles per hour.
And by the way, I wanted to ask you this real quickly to get a little, you know, technical, a little geeky on the tech side on this. But just to point out to people that the difference between each category, you know, you think, well, a category to three to four, what is that? It's a big difference, right? Because I think about hurricane fours that I've been through. It was nothing like the five.
So to get a little geeky, and you know, this audience will certainly understand this. When you the wind force, the destructive force of the wind varies based on a quadratic equation. So, if you double the wind speed, if the wind speed goes from a minimal hurricane of 75 miles per hour to a Cat 4, 150 mile per hour hurricane, the destructive force is 2 squared, which is 4 times as strong. So 150 mile per hour wind is not just doubly destructive as a 75 mile an hour wind, it is 4 times more destructive than a 75 mile an hour wind. So definitely it's not a linear situation. It does get very scary very quickly, and those major hurricanes in terms of windstorm are the ones that can do that big time damage.
All right, so for today's program, because all week, by the way, we have been talking about Hurricane Andrew, the 25th anniversary, and we've collected so many great stories throughout the week. If you haven't had the chance to listen to some of those stories we've been playing on air, please go to the website, WLRN.org. Check out some of those stories, some fascinating memories, some terrifying memories, too, of what it was like living through that storm. And by the way, just as a reminder, I mean, Andrew was, you know, in today's dollars, what, $26 billion of damage?
I believe in today's dollars, it would have been $44
billion. Okay, all right.
So it was maybe yes. 26 back then.
That's right.
And again, it missed Miami proper by a good 15 miles to the south. So something a little bit further north would have been catastrophic.
And again, that website, WLRN.org/Andrew. Check out the stories. They are really fascinating. But let's talk about, this is the segment I want to talk today is about what if another five came through South Florida. Think about everything that's changed. So building codes have changed. Insurance issues have changed. Supposedly, you know, emergency management systems have also improved, that also from Katrina. You know, getting supplies would be better, supposedly. We didn't have cell phones back then. We did, but really only a few people did. We depend on those. What would happen with that? More high rises. So I want to talk about is South Florida ready for a big storm? And again, I want to hear your thoughts on this. If you have memories too from Hurricane Andrew, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that the city is built, is South Florida, not just, you know, Miami, West Palm Beach, Fort Lauderdale, is it ready for a Category 5? 800-743-WLRN. Again, we want to hear your thoughts, your comments on this. Share your stories if you do have one. 800-743-WLRN. Let's go to the phones. I want to go to Abraham in Miami Gardens.
How you doing? Hello, yeah, how
hey,
you doing?
Abraham, you're there. Go ahead.
Listen, I'm driving in the rain coming from Pembroke Pines. My wife had to keep a baby because the babysitter got sick. And I just happened to be listening, and I called in to tell you that during that time I was a social worker performing the duties of an assistant director of Beckham Hall Homeless Shelter for the county, and our director, Al Moore, lived down south, and his house got devastated. And I ended up with the responsibility of trying to find food for 75 residents of the shelter, and it was an amazing experience. I went here and there and got this and that, and we were able to keep the guys fed and well-kept until things got back in order. And the primary reason why I had to do that is because all of the people who catered food, they just weren't up and operational. So that left us with the responsibility of trying to get that taken care of. While I also had to take care of a sick mother and my five kids at home. So it was an amazing experience. While we didn't have a whole lot of structural damage, we did have a lot of power outages in my area for about like 6 or 7 days. But other than that, we were able to make it.
Abraham, if another Category 5 came through, what would you do?
Well, listen, let me tell you something, man. When you have the spirit of helping, I made 7 missionary journeys to the Gulf Coast during Katrina. And as we anticipate Harvey in Texas, I'm thinking in advance now, man, that if they need me, I don't have the van I had then, but I'll rent a van and I'll go around to people of goodwill and grab stuff. And I have a friend who is always willing to ride. We're in our 70s now, but whatever we need to do, man, we'll do it to try to help help each other. Because one of the things that we have to make sure we work on and continue to uplift is man's humanity to man. And it has nothing to do with politics or race, creed, or color, or gender. It's just that we're all human and we all want to live as long as we can.
Abraham, thank you so much for the story. Thanks for sharing with us. I really appreciate it. Let me take one more call real quickly here. I want to go to Lori and Davey. Lori, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say, you know, thinking back on Andrew, it just reminds me of how fragile we all are. And I wanted to also mention the Community Emergency Response Training, a program called CERT, C-E-R-T, which is offered in just about every city in the U.S., free to residents. It teaches you how to survive, how to deal with different disasters until trained emergency personnel can get to you. Once a hurricane hits, the streets are going to be closed, trees may be down. 911 is not going to answer your call.
You may be trapped. You may be trapped.
Yes. And this teaches, the CERT program teaches you how to make you, how to keep you and your family safe, and then to reach out to your neighbors, your street, your community. And it's a fabulous program offered free in just about every city in the U.S., and I strongly encourage people to Google it, CERT.
Thank
you. Community Emergency Response Training.
Lori, thank you so much for bringing that up, and I'll make sure that we put that up on the website, too, so people will have the chance to look at that. I appreciate you sharing that with us. You know, Renee Rodriguez, you kind of gave me a scare. Now, I'm lucky for me, I live low to the ground. I'm not really big fan of living in high rises, but we have a lot of them now in South Florida, all up and down South Florida. But you had a story recently in the Miami Herald about, well, you know, are they safe? Should you evacuate them? What happens if you stay in one? I mean, really, do you think Miami structurally is ready for another five?
According to the building codes that have been put into place, and, you know, they get ratcheted up, you know, every year or so, like they get stricter and stricter and stricter. So a lot of these new high-rises that have gone up since, say, 2002, which is when the big construction boom started here, have been built to a code that was much stronger than what it used to be. And there has been a sense of complacency that has set in among people who live there saying, oh, you know, this building is safe. You know, like, I don't need to go and, you know, have high-impact windows, and I can just ride out the storm. What you're not taking into consideration are things such as flooding. For example, Tropical Storm Emily showed us a couple of weeks ago that Brickell and Miami Beach were basically underwater, and after just a couple of hours of rain, the hurricane delivers a lot more rain than that. So you could be conceivably cut off from, you know, if you live on a 40th floor, you could conceivably be stuck there unless you're willing to go up and down 40 flights of stairs. And you're also at the mercy of your neighbor. If somebody opens a window during a hurricane and you live in a high rise and that wind gets inside, it is going to smash through the walls, in the interior walls that are dividing one apartment from the other. It, you know, these are scenarios that sound horrific, but the fact of the matter is no one really knows what will happen despite the stronger building codes.
A lot of these high rises, though, they're in evacuation areas, right?
Almost all of the new ones are in evacuation areas. But again, you know, people feel, you know, it's not like a house where you feel vulnerable. You're on the 30th floor, you know, oh, you know, I'm going to be okay. My windows, like, I don't even have to put up shutters because my windows are so strong. And people don't take consideration that, you know, the further away, the further up you go in a building, the stronger the wind force is going to be. So it could be, say, 100 miles an hour at ground level. If you're on the 30th floor, it could be 140, 150 miles per hour.
Yeah. Rene, you're right. I'll interject John, here, yeah, that what you need to plan for if you live in these buildings is a full category higher. So if the hurricane is forecast to arrive as a Cat 2, you should plan for winds that are going to be Cat 3 at your level. And, of course, with the uncertainty involved these days in intensity forecasting, which is an area of meteorology as far as hurricane intensity forecast that has not improved all that much over the last several decades, so we still face tremendous challenges of knowing just when a hurricane is going to strengthen or weaken. Well, if it could strengthen, just like Andrew did as it was just arriving in South Florida, well, then not just one category higher, but it could be even stronger if the forecast is incorrect. So you need to keep that in mind if you live in a building. I think those interior hallways, actually outside of your front door, and actually you go to the hallway, which has no windows and no access to the outside, could be a safe place to ride out the wind. But like Rene just said, you know, all services are going to go away. Your elevator's not going to work. The water is not going to get pumped up to your apartment, you know, and then on top of that, you can't leave because it's flooded with, you know, 6, 8, 10 feet of water down below from the storm surge. So, yeah.
Elliot Kleinberg, Palm Beach County, one of the things too that we had reported earlier this summer is that they have new flood maps. But just get a picture of Palm Beach County, and not as many high rises, but is Palm Beach County ready for a Category 5? And I had to look, by the way, the last time that area, that West Palm Beach, got hit by anything like a 4 or higher goes back to the late 40s. But are they ready?
Well, of course, a lot of people in Dade County who came from other places came from places that have seen hurricanes, like the Caribbean. A lot of people in Palm Beach County came from places not so much, like New England, New York, the Midwest. Those are places that if they get a hurricane, it's not on the order of an Andrew. Palm Beach County is so large and so expansive, and it's got so many transplants. The flood maps did get recently changed, and of course, what a lot of people don't understand about evacuation is that you evacuate for water. There were a lot of places where people were leaving their homes where they really should not have, because their home was just fine and they weren't in an area where it could flood. And so the emergency manager said, well, why are you leaving? If your house is built properly, that's the best place to be. And if you are leaving, just go a few miles. Don't get in your car and start driving to Orlando. And then, of course, we have this gigantic lake that you might have heard of. I did a book in 2003 called Black Cloud about the great 1928 hurricane. And it's important for people to remember that the biggest killer hurricanes have been water hurricanes. Andrew killed, I think, 15 people in Miami-Dade County. I mean, think about that for a second. 500,000 people experienced Category 5 hurricane winds, and there were almost no deaths. The 1928 hurricane drowned probably 3,000 people. Katrina was only a Category 2 hurricane, I believe, in New Orleans, and look at how many people it drowned. Hurricane Harvey, they're not talking so much about the winds as they are the fact that they might get 3 feet of flooding. So people get hung up on the winds, and it's really the water that they probably most have to worry about.
I want to take one phone call real quickly here. Philbert, who used to live in Homestead. Philbert, I remember Homestead. That was devastated. You were near the Air Force Base, right?
Yes. And what happened, I'm from a different country. I'm from Georgetown, Guyana. And I never experienced nothing like that in my life. And when I came out the next morning, I couldn't believe what I see. And the first thing I think about, how I'm going to get back to my country. So after that, for the past couple of years, it's like when I hear hurricane, it just scared me. You know, it was when I come out, I want to know what really happened.
And if a hurricane's coming, do you have an evacuation plan, or do you just stick it out?
No, we didn't have no evacuation. I was down in the Keys fishing, and I never catch so much of fish like that day. It was just a beautiful day, and the next thing I heard, they were saying we need to evacuate from the Keys. And then I had so much of fish in the cooler, I was scared. When I went home, and we heard about the hurricane, we heard late. And I prayed for my life with my family in a bathroom. and a fight and pray. I never pray like that my whole life. Yes.
It was
real bad.
Yeah, Philbert, I tell you what, that is one of the, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. That is one of the things, the day before was so serene. So beautiful. Let's finish up real quickly here. John Morales, let me ask you, weather for you in not predicting hurricanes, but tracking them and informing us of what's going on, that's also changed a lot, too. How much better prepared are we for, a five if it's coming when it comes to actually knowing where it's going to land or at least the information you get out to people?
Yeah, I mean, if you're asking about the forecasts, definitely for track. They are tremendously better than they were back when Andrew hit. As a matter of fact, now we have a 5-day projection from the National Hurricane Center as opposed to a 3-day projection of its future path. So that is, to a degree, an improvement, although I will tell you this, the fact that we start watching these things 2 weeks prior gives me some concern because there's just so much hype that by the time we get to the moment to get ready, I think people are just mentally fatigued of hearing this. I've had a lot of interactions with Brian Norcross, former chief meteorologist at my station WTVJ, recently because of Andrew's anniversary. And he feels that it was actually better when we only heard about it 2 days prior. And he said for Andrew, people heard about it on Friday. Saturday, they realized it was getting stronger and heading our way. Sunday, everybody got ready. And by that night, the roads were empty. People were scared, but they were as ready as they could be for a Cat 5 hurricane.
I bet you people who live through Andrew, like Philbert, they're listening to the 2 weeks you're talking about it, and we're paying attention. Elliot Kleinberg, real quickly, your thoughts on if even the whole region is ready. What's one big concern?
I guess the biggest concern is that there are so many people who were not here for Andrew and even people who were not here for Wilma, which was only, 12 years ago, who either moved here since then or weren't born or were too young to appreciate. And the forecasters talk so many times about hurricane amnesia. That used to be one of Max Mayfield's favorite phrases, where people forget. We had Matthew come through last year, and how many people were all of a sudden first going to the home improvement store when they really should have known better?
Yeah, waiting till the very end. And Renee Rodriguez just wrote, quickly, anything that concerns you about preparation here in Miami-Dade? Are we ready?
There's this term that I learned when I was writing this story called recency bias, which is something that insurance agents use. And basically, since there hasn't been a major storm that has hit the area in X amount of years, people have been becoming, again, a little bit more complacent. They say, well, this thing is never going to happen. You have to make sure, especially if you're in a high rise, you have to make sure your association has plans in place for emergency evacuation. It's very important. Some associations do and some do not. And you also have to double check your insurance because the exterior of the building may be covered.
Oh, know the insurance. Absolutely. I have to end it there. Renee Rodriguez is with the Miami Herald. We heard from Elliot Kleinberg from the Palm Beach Post and John Morales, NBC6 meteorologist, here in studio with us. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And just a reminder, too, that you can hear all the wonderful stories that we got from you, from Hurricane Andrew, your memories at WLRN.org/Andrew. All right, coming up next, the attack in Barcelona has sparked some fears that maybe pedestrian areas need to be protected, and Miami Beach has taken steps. We'll find out more. Coming up next on WLRN's The Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. On August 17th in Barcelona, terrorists drove a van through the pedestrian area known as Las Ramblas. 13 people died. 130 were injured. This past week, Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine announced to residents in an email that the pedestrian area of Lincoln Road will be blocked off at both ends with concrete barriers. This is a move to prevent anyone from driving a vehicle through crowded walkways. Is this necessary now in every city with pedestrian centers? Is it just the norm in today's world? And what other areas of South Florida considering or should consider such a move? Let me introduce our guest for this segment. Lulu Ramadan is the Southern Palm Beach County reporter for the Palm Beach Post. Lulu, welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Joey Fletcher joins us from the Miami Herald, and he covers Miami Beach. He's in Doral. Joey, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Joey, real quickly, the mayor sent out this email to residents letting them know, basically saying what?
He was saying that the city was going to quickly negotiate with a contractor to build concrete barriers at the ends of the pedestrian mall, Lincoln Road, so that is at Alton Road and Washington Avenue. And some of them are actually up. I got a picture just now, recently, in the last hour.
They already put them up.
Yeah, that they've put. They're basically the concrete barriers that you would see like on a construction project, like on a roadway project. And that is in advance of a more aesthetically pleasing, as he said, permanent situation with permanent like bollards, like kind of pillars that would keep cars from driving onto.
And
Lincoln
is this
Road.
Is this a direct reaction to what happened in Barcelona?
It is, yeah. It is a direct reaction. It's interesting also to note that this is actually not a new conversation. I mean, he added a level of urgency to it that this week with his email and the push to get those up, those temporary barriers up. But just like Barcelona wasn't the first instance of this happening in Europe, the conversation actually was brought up in January. Commissioner Michael Grieco actually asked for the city to incorporate in a design of an overall redo and makeover of Lincoln Road to include bollards so that vehicles couldn't drive onto to the mall.
And bollards are these barriers, as you had mentioned. Yeah. Lulu, is there any conversation in other cities around South Florida, up in Palm Beach County, with pedestrian areas that may need to be blocked off? And what are some of the ones that you'd think of that probably would consider it?
Yeah, you know, it's a conversation that city and county officials often have after an incident like this. I know while they haven't discussed putting barriers, they do often take security measures. I know last year after a similar attack in Nice, they decided to amp up security for some of the events in Delray Beach in particular. The police did mention that they had to increase security for events that would shut down Atlantic Avenue because pedestrians, businesses would put little booths and for little festivals and fairs and things like that. And it would be just, you know, pedestrians would be scattered along the avenue. And
What are some of the areas in Palm Beach County that you think might need something like this?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is Atlantic Avenue. They do have a really busy, bustling downtown in Delray Beach. And they often do close down that road so that pedestrians can use it for festivals. And people are constantly walking up and down that avenue during all times of the day. So that's the first one that would come to mind. There's also a lot of pedestrian activity in West Palm Beach as well. That's a destination area. They obviously don't get as, you would say, as much foot traffic as Miami Beach, but they are, you know, big areas and, you know, they are popular areas here in Palm Beach County.
This question to both of you, Lulu, I'll start with you, is I wonder how often do, you know, city commissions, city leaders, mayors talk about homeland defense, talk about terrorist attack. We tend to think of places like New York City, London, Barcelona, but West Palm Beach, Miami?
Yeah.
I mean, but Lulu, how often do they talk? How often do they even mention terrorism?
Well, you know, there's really an interesting dynamic in Palm Beach County. It seems that a lot of attacks have some sort of link to Palm Beach County. Delray Beach in particular has a really interesting history with it. Following the 9/11 attacks, the police department actually created a homeland security program where they enlisted veterans from the area to watch over major just buildings and areas in Delray, in particular places like our cultural center, the old school square, Atlantic Avenue, some of the older historic homes, because the police department didn't have the resources to really be thinking about that because they were dealing with day-to-day crimes.
And real quickly, Joey, same thing. Miami Beach, the terrorism pop up on the conversation?
More often than one might think, actually. The commissioners, as I mentioned before, after previous attacks of similar nature in Europe in the past few years, it'll come up at a meeting. They'll talk about, you know, well, you know, Miami Beach is an international destination. It's so attractive to tourists. It brings a lot of people from all over the world. And there are what you call soft targets in Miami Beach. I mean, Lincoln Road is one of them. Another pedestrian walkway is Española Way, with, you know, lined by restaurant tables, and there's a lot of people on foot. All of people want to be outside and on foot in Miami Beach, so it could be a target. And
all right.
They know that.
And just in 30 seconds or less, if you could, Mayor Philip Levine sent a letter to the governor asking lawmakers to do what? They're looking for the state to help out.
Yeah, they're looking for the state to help pay for this and to help also assess where there might be other risks in other cities in Florida and to work with local police departments on training for if situations like this could arise, how to deal with them.
All right. I've been talking with Joey Fletcher of the Miami Herald and also Lulu Ramadan from the Southern Palm Beach County. She's a reporter with the Palm Beach Post. Thank you both so much. A little bit tight on time there, but wanted to get that story out. Thank you so much. And that will do it for the program today. Florida Roundup is produced by Gina Jordan. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. Our technical supervisor, Jason Zapka. You can download a podcast of this program. Search WLRN on your podcast app. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening.